Welcome to the African American Hour. I'm Byron Buckner. Today I have readings from Barron's Magazine, the New York Times, the South Bend, Indiana Tribune newspaper, the Associated Press, Time Magazine, and I'm going to start with a story about Kansas City, Kansas, from the Kansas City Star newspaper. The title is, Quindaro Ruins to Receive $1 Million Donation. What could it mean for the Civil War era site? It was written by Luke Nosiak and by Katie Bernard. It was published December 8, 2023. A decades-long effort to preserve the Quindaro ruins is set to receive the largest sum of money it has ever seen through a government settlement agreement. The total, $1 million. It's a figure advocates and city leaders believe could begin to transform the historic site, but it's unclear exactly how it will be spent. The money came from a settlement between On Goal, Sporting KC's parent company, and the unified government of Wyandotte County and Kansas City, Kansas, after Oracle, formerly known as Cerner, left Kansas City, Kansas before fulfilling obligations tied to state incentives. On Goal had been a guarantor for Cerner on the agreement. We want that to be a wonderful message that this was the gateway to freedom for many Americans in our country, County Administrator David Johnson said this week at a speech. The funding represents a major windfall for Quindaro preservation after years of slow progress and insufficient funding to restore the ruins of the Civil War era boomtown and outposts along the Underground Railroad. The project became something of a political football this spring after the Republican-led legislature appropriated $250,000 for a strategic plan for the site after State Representative Marvin Robinson, a Kansas City Democrat who has spent decades advocating for Quindaro, voted with Republicans to override Democratic Governor Laura Kelly's vetoes on policies limiting access to food stamps and regulating the lives of transgender Kansans. Kelly vetoed the funding, but in the time since, Republican lawmakers have pledged future support for the project. Federal lawmakers are pushing to make the site a National Historic Landmark, a step above its current status as a national commemorative site, and Kelly's administration negotiated the settlement that could bring the project more money than it has ever seen. That change in designation would bring a higher status and an easier pathway to grants. I was very grateful to the governor because she showed she's a larger public leader than what I had perceived, Robinson said of the settlement. However, he's concerned the funding will ultimately be squandered on yet another set of plans for the site, rather than invested in work to preserve the ruins before it's too late. The ruins have 22 foundations that are still discernible. They've been planning for all these years, Robinson said. There hasn't been any activity to preserve them since 2008. The money is earmarked for building improvements, including land acquisition, master planning, a new welcome center, museum, and other improvements, according to the settlement. A Wyandotte County spokesperson said the unified government will not receive the funds until 2024. The Reverend Stacy Evans, who chairs the Quindaro Ruins Project Foundation Board, said $1 million would easily be the most money the project has received. The money will go through the unified government, which in the past has not always been a good partner, said Evans, who has been spearheading efforts to preserve Quindaro since 2009. But she is hopeful the project will see the money after meeting with Johnston, who was hired earlier this year. Evans, who would use the money to create a design plan at between $250,000 to $350,000 and hire a project manager for probably around $100,000. The rest of the money could be used to stabilize the foundations, she said. In the future, the foundation wants to create trails with signs and interactive activities, an amphitheater, and an archive interpretive center, among other attractions. That's way more than $1 million, Evans said, noting that those estimates are in the tens of millions. A national jewel. Supporting efforts to restore the ruins to become a destination attraction is among Wyandotte County's legislative priorities for the upcoming session in Topeka. It's a new item among the unified government's priority list, Assistant County Administrator Alan Howell said at a special session last week when city and county officials hosted the state delegation. Mayor Tyrone Garner said Johnston is taking the lead on getting a robust proposal on the ruins to the Board of Commissioners, the county's governing body. I have been asked by several individuals, if I had my magic wand, what would I want, Garner said. Well, I'd love to see a billion-dollar star bond project that would link the Quindaro ruins to the Rock Island Bridge as two anchoring economic development tourist destinations and everything in between that redeveloped. Redeveloping the Rock Island Bridge near Hy-Vee Arena in the West Bottoms into an entertainment destination over the Kansas River is expected to be completed next year. Linking it to the ruins, Garner said, could totally transform Northeast Kansas City, Kansas, downtown, and the Armourdale neighborhood. He believed it could be done, given bipartisan support on the issue. We all see Wyandotte County as being the gateway to Kansas, Garner said, adding that such revitalization east of Interstate 635 would be monumental. Wyandotte County officials have heard from state and federal lawmakers that the county needs to show them something to invest in the ruins, Johnston said. Local leaders have gotten the message loud and clear, he said, noting officials will be working on a master plan over the next year. At his State of the Government address, Garner said Tuesday, investment opportunities were being cultivated to make the ruins the national jewel it has always deserved to be. County commissioners then voted Thursday to create a 14-member advisory board to coordinate economic redevelopment strategies for eastern Kansas City, Kansas, which includes the ruins in riverfront areas. The members will come from fields in economic development, finance, historic preservation, and law, and will hold monthly meetings. We don't need to kick this can down the road any further, Commissioner Chuck Stites, District 7, said before the vote. Let's see where this takes us. That was the article titled, Quindaro Ruins to Receive $1 Million Donation. What Could It Mean for the Civil War Era Site? It was published in the Kansas City Star's KansasCity.com website on December 8, 2023. My next reading is from Indiana and the South Bend Tribune newspaper. The title of this column is, Project Needs Your Help Finding the Untold Stories of Black Studebaker Workers. It was written by Alicia Redding and published December 8, 2023. At its basic level, history is about telling stories, fleshing out details, painting a picture of a time, a place, a people. But some parts of history, much of it involving African American or other minority communities' lives and experiences, go untold. When that happens, it's often left to those who live that history, whether it be firsthand or through familial connection, to help fill in the blanks, or risk losing that history forever. That thought resonates during this weekend's 60th anniversary of the closing of Studebaker, a key marker in South Bend's history. Stories about a thriving factory that employed 22,000 at its peak and of the devastation that came upon the city on December 9, 1963, with the announcement that Studebaker would close. As that history is being reexamined, a new collaboration between the Indiana University South Bend Civil Rights Heritage Center and the Studebaker National Museum seeks to engage the public to help tell the story of black workers at Studebaker. George Garner, assistant director and curator at the Civil Rights Center, is of course familiar with Studebaker history. The center has a treasure trove of oral histories, more than 170 stories told by local residents who lived through and worked for the civil rights movement. Many of these stories touched on Studebaker, hardly surprising given that, as he explains, it was so important in the Great Migration, the mass movement of black people from the Jim Crow South to northern, midwestern, and western states. Studebaker was a major factor in the radical transformation of the African-American community in this city throughout the 20th century. But something was missing in the stories. So many of them talked about Studebaker, Garner explains, but what they don't do is say, here's what happened when I went to work. It's a piece of an overall narrator's life. Making Studebaker not a piece of those stories, but the whole, is the aim of the joint effort of the center and the museum that will record stories of African Americans who worked in the Studebaker factory and of their descendants affected by that work. Kyle Sater, curator at the Studebaker Museum, remembers a discussion involving how the museum was telling the stories of workers and interpreting their experiences. Part of the process was asking, what are we missing? The answer? Well, we don't have a lot specifically about the African American experience, he says, noting there are some oral histories, but not a concerted effort. They decided that collecting the stories from people who were there or from their families was a way to fill that gap. Oral histories are a great resource for historians, but also for the public to really learn firsthand what it was like to live in a certain time, work in a certain place, Sater says. Launching the project around the 60th anniversary of Studebaker's closing makes sense, as does recognizing the urgency of the moment. For some members of that generation, Garner says, we are unfortunately just running out of time. Sater, noting that the youngest Studebaker workers at the time of the closing would be in or on the cusp of their 80s, says, I'm hopeful that there are still some folks out there who are willing and able to share. If not, we'd love to hear from family and friends. Such untold stories, as Sater calls them, are meaningful, but some of them may not be heartwarming. Garner notes that Studebaker was, for a time at least, the largest industrial employer of African-American people, and those workers were basically doing the dirtiest and most dangerous jobs. That sort of detail is another reason why collecting these stories is important, according to Lillian Magers Pershing, a student worker at the Civil Rights Center who is working on the project. She says it isn't difficult to find stories about the experiences of Studebaker workers, but hearing African-American perspectives is literally another story. Something as simple as going to work day to day is going to be very different, especially in the 1950s and 60s, and the context that they're bringing in with them is very important, the South Bend native says. Garner says he hopes to add about 3 to 6 histories a year over the next 2 or 3 years, and believes the national reach of the Studebaker Museum will help expand their search. We're interested in getting honest feedback. For some who lived through the closing, it was a really difficult time. Sharing that openly and honestly is a piece of that history that's necessary to share. The first step to sharing those necessary stories is filling out the form at the website go.iu.edu/Studebaker Stories. That's Studebaker. If you're somebody who knows somebody, fill out that form, because there are questions specifically for that. If you are somebody who worked there, fill out that form. If you're a family member of somebody, fill out that form, Garner says. Fill out that form and fill in the gaps of local history. That was the column titled, Project Needs Your Help Finding the Untold Stories of Black Studebaker Workers. It was written by Alicia Redding and published December 8, 2023 in the South Bend, Indiana Tribune newspaper. My next reading is about architecture, and it's from the New York Times newspaper. The title is, Black Woman Rises to the Top of Her Field. It was written by Jane Margulies and published December 2, 2023. When Kimberly Dowdell becomes president of the American Institute of Architects, her ascent will be noteworthy. Dowdell, an architect in a profession that is overwhelmingly white and male, is a black woman, the first to fill the post in the group's 166-year history. African Americans make up 13.6% of the U.S. population, but only 1.8% of licensed architects in the country are black, according to the National Council of Architectural Registration Boards. Fewer than one quarter of the nearly 120,000 licensed architects in the United States are women, and not even one half of 1% of architects are black women. Black female architects are so few and far between, and obtaining licensure is such a point of pride among them, that many take pains to note their place in the chronology of advancement in the field. Dowdell, 40, said that in 2013 she became the 295th living black woman to be licensed in the United States. There are small signs of change. Nearly 3% of architects who received their license last year were black, and 43% of new architects were women. We're working on moving the needle, but we'll need at least a decade, said Dowdell, who is the director of strategic relations at the design firm HOK and is based in Chicago. She pointed out that it could take 10 years or longer to obtain an architecture degree, fill a work experience requirement, and pass licensure exams to become a registered architect. Yet progress toward racial and gender equity in the profession is by no means guaranteed, especially now that the Supreme Court has rolled back affirmative action in college admissions. Some say there has been backpedaling on diversity efforts that companies trumpeted after the Black Lives Matter protests. There's always been a backlash to black progress, says Sharon Egretta Sutton, 82, a distinguished visiting professor at the Parsons School of Design in New York, and the 12th black female licensed U.S. architect. The proportion of black architects is significantly below the share of black professionals in other fields requiring intensive study and rigorous exams. More than 6% of lawyers in the United States are black, according to data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. The dearth of black architects means that the buildings in which many minority Americans live, work, and play are often designed by people who may not be attuned to their cultural reference points, experts say. And the design of all spaces, regardless of who uses them, can suffer when decisions do not include a variety of perspectives. Even memorials to enslaved Africans in this country may be designed by non-black people. But the scarcity of black architects can be self-perpetuating, black industry observers say. Youngsters may not learn of the profession if there are no architects in their communities. Then, too, black parents may be wary of the profession if architecture enters their lives only as a threat. As with the arrival of luxury housing that displaces neighborhood residents. When you see architecture as the enemy, it's difficult to have children say, "I want to do that," said Craig Wilkins, associate professor of architecture at the University of Michigan. And parents may be reluctant to incur debt to pay for a child's architecture degree, which can require thousands of dollars in supplies on top of tuition, given that the median salary, under $83,000, lacks those in adjacent fields like engineering. The cost of licensure is another reason that architecture has been regarded as a profession of privilege. Candidates must pass 6 tests of the architectural registration exam, totaling more than $1,400, and it is common for candidates to have to take tests multiple times to pass. Practice materials alone are expensive. For decades, black architects have worked to make their way in the field. On the heels of the civil rights movement, many started their own firms. Back then, they were limited in how far they could advance in majority firms, said Stephen Lewis, a principal at ZGF, a majority-owned design firm. In 1971, Black Architects united to form the National Organization of Minority Architects. It gave us a safe space where we could discuss issues but also share our work and celebrate our work, said Lewis, a former president of the organization. In the 1980s, two NOMA members started searching out licensed black architects for what they would call the Directory of African American Architects. We would go to conferences and ask around, said Branford Grant, one of the directory creators and the interim chair of the architecture department at Howard University. Their first edition, printed in 1991, had 870 names. Today, NOMA maintains the directory online. Current total, 2,535. 1,942 men, 593 women. Richie Hands, 34, was one of the newly licensed architects recognized in a ceremony at NOMA's annual conference recently. "Now I can say I'm an architect, which is awesome," he said. Black women have rooted one another on. Catherine T. Prigmore, director of operations in Washington for Moody Nolan, a black-owned firm, has organized presentations at conferences in which women share their stories of adversity and achievement. Catherine Williams, an architect in Falls Church, Virginia, founded the Black Women in Architecture Network to bring colleagues together for brunches and raise funds to help licensing candidates with exam fees. Despite wide-ranging efforts, the most significant gains for people of color since 2018 has been made by those who identify as Latino, and black women appear to be making more headway than black men. The lack of progress has discouraged some. "Build the pipeline. I've been hearing that for 50 years," said Sutton, who has written about her experience being recruited to Columbia's architecture program after a 1968 campus uprising and the students' drive to improve slum conditions near the school. "Working outside the system may offer the most hope at this point," she said. "Maybe change needs to come from the ground up." That was the New York Times article titled, "Black Woman Rises to the Top of Her Field." It was written by Jane Margulies and published December 2nd, 2023. My next reading is titled, "Here's What's in the Final Version of the Controversial Advanced Placement African American Studies Curriculum." It was written by Olivia B. Waxman and published December 6, 2023 in Time Magazine's Time.com website. Despite Florida's attempt to ban schools from teaching AP African American Studies earlier this year, the College Board on Wednesday, December 6th, released the final course framework. Knowledge of several hot-button political topics and current events, including the Black Lives Matter movement and the debate over reparations, remain optional for the Advanced Placement, AP, exam. The new framework adds back in material on intersectionality and some new sources and topics on white supremacist violence and black arts and entertainment. AP African American Studies is in its second and final year of a pilot program, and the new framework comes almost a year after Florida Governor Ron DeSantis started publicly attacking the class as indoctrination and accusing it of trying to push a political agenda during a larger national reaction to anti-racist programming in schools and workplaces in the aftermath of George Floyd's murder. In the new framework, topics that Florida objected to in January, like Black Lives Matter and reparations, appear in a separate section called Further Exploration, which lists examples of things that teachers could talk more about in class, but that would not be required knowledge for the AP exam. Previous versions of the framework highlighted those topics as example essay topics that students could pursue, though they still weren't required material for the exam. Other topics in the Further Exploration section include incarceration, talking about the disproportionate incarceration of African Americans, black cuisine, such as soul food, and black women writers and filmmakers like Ava DuVernay. The College Board released the course framework online February 1st, the start of Black History Month, so the public could form its own opinions on the material amid the political pushback. Then in April, the College Board announced there would be more changes to the framework, and those are the changes that came out Wednesday. 60 high schools nationwide participated in the first year of the pilot, and nearly 700 schools are currently participating in more than 40 states, plus the District of Columbia. In spring 2024, students can take an AP African American Studies exam and potentially earn college credit. When the February 1st framework came out, some scholars balked that it didn't include certain black thought leaders who appeared as required reading in previous drafts, like Kimberly Crenshaw, who popularized intersectionality, the idea of seeing discrimination through a lens of racial and gender identities. The College Board said it made those changes before the Florida Department of Education started tweeting about them. In the latest version of the framework, intersectionality gets top billing. One of the featured topics is called The Black Feminist Movement, Womanism, and Intersectionality, and lists Crenshaw's work as essential knowledge. New sources in the unit Origins of the African Diaspora include artifacts to help teachers teach the history of the African continent. The topic White Supremacist Violence in the Red Summer now features photographs of the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre. And there's a new topic devoted just to African Americans who served in World War II, like Charity Adams, the highest-ranking black woman officer who ran the operation that delivered mail from the United States to troops in the European theater. Most of the new topics fall into the arts and entertainment category. In Black Life in Theater, TV, and Film, students will watch clips of dances on the TV show Soul Train, while in Symphony in Black, black performance in music, theater, and film, students will be immersed in Duke Ellington's music. When students get to African Americans in sports, they will learn that black athletes in Halifax, Nova Scotia founded a hockey league in 1895 that predates the NHL and might see a photo of 49ers NFL players taking a knee at a 2017 game against the Seattle Seahawks. In the arts sections, students will see Kendi Wiley's 2018 portrait of President Barack Obama and Amy Sherrill's portrait of First Lady Michelle Obama. Schools have been asking for AP African American Studies for the past decade, but course development efforts accelerated after Floyd's murder sparked a national reckoning on race relations. The course framework released Wednesday, December 6, is the culmination of 3 years of work in which 300 experts in African American Studies and high school AP teachers were consulted. That was the article titled, Here's What's in the Final Version of the Controversial Advanced Placement African American Studies Curriculum. It was published December 6, 2023, in Time Magazine's Time.com website. My next reading is from the Associated Press. The title is, America's Black Attorneys General Discuss Race, Politics, and the Justice System. It was written by Matt Brown and published December 1st, 2023. The American legal system is facing a crisis of trust in communities around the country with people of all races and across the political spectrum. For many, recent protests against police brutality called attention to long-standing discrepancies in the administration of justice. For others, criticism of perceived conflicts of interest in the judiciary, as well as aspersions cast by former President Donald Trump and others on the independence of judges and law enforcement, have further damaged faith in the rule of law among broad swaths of the public. Yet, many black attorneys understood the disparate impact the legal system can have on different communities long before the 2020 protests following the murder of George Floyd at the hands of police. Many pursued legal careers and entered that same system to improve it, with some rising to one of his most influential roles, the top law enforcement official, Attorney General. There's a record number of black attorneys general, 7 in total, serving today. 2 black attorneys, Eric Holder and Loretta Lynch, have served as U.S. Attorney General. And the Vice President, Kamala Harris, was the first black woman elected Attorney General. In that same moment of increased representation, the U.S. is gripped by intense debates regarding justice, race, and democracy. Black prosecutors have emerged as central figures litigating those issues, highlighting the achievements and limits of black communal efforts to reform the justice system. The Associated Press spoke with 6 sitting black attorneys general about their views on racial equity, public safety, police accountability, and protecting democratic institutions. While their worldviews and strategies sometimes clash, the group felt united in a mission to better a system they all agreed too often failed the people it's meant to serve. A spokesperson for Kentucky Attorney General Daniel Cameron, a Republican, did not respond to multiple requests for an interview. All interviewed attorneys general are Democrats. Each attorney general discussed how their backgrounds informed their approach to the law. I loved math and I thought I was going to become an accountant. Clearly that went a different direction as life happened, said Andrea Campbell, the Attorney General of Massachusetts. She soon began a career providing legal aid in her community because most of my childhood was entangled with the criminal legal system. Anthony Brown and Kwame Raoul learned from their fathers, who were both physicians and Caribbean immigrants. Raoul, now the Attorney General of Illinois, said he learned to never forget where you came from and never forget the struggles that others go through. Brown's father drew satisfaction from knowing that he made a difference in people's lives and taught him the importance of public service. I saw that every day as a kid growing up, said Brown, a retired Army colonel now serving as Attorney General of Maryland. Letitia James, the New York Attorney General, said she came from humble beginnings and was shaped by those who know struggle, pain, loss, but also perseverance. Aaron Ford, the Attorney General of Nevada, attributed his achievements because the government helped in a time of need to get to my next level. And Keith Ellison, the Attorney General of Minnesota, was raised on stories of his grandparents organizing black voters in Louisiana at the height of Jim Crow when they endured bomb threats and a burned cross at their home. That's who raised me. Because of that, I have a sensitivity to people who are being punished for trying to do the right thing. And that's what we dedicate our work to. And there's a lot more to it, Ellison said. On reducing disparities in the criminal justice system, the American criminal justice system is plagued with well-documented inequality and racial disparities at every level. And while an outsized portion of defendants are people of color, prosecutors are mostly white. Many black prosecutors entered the legal profession to bring the perspective of communities most impacted by the system into its decision-making process. If we are in these roles, I think people expect, and rightfully so, that we will take on criminal legal reform, that we will take out bias that exists in criminal or civil prosecutions, that we will focus on communities of color and do it in such a way that recognizes those communities are often overpoliced and underprotected, Campbell said. Efforts at reforming the justice system have been mixed. The disparity between black and white rates of incarceration dropped by 40% between 2000 and 2020, according to a September 2022 report by the Council on Criminal Justice. But while the number of people incarcerated overall across that period slightly fell, policing and sentencing policies vary by state, leading to divergent realities across regions. Brown has made reducing Maryland's high rate of black male incarceration his number one strategy priority. Maryland has the highest percentage of black people incarcerated of any state, though southeastern states like Alabama, Louisiana, and Mississippi have higher total populations of incarcerated black people. He created a civil rights division in his office and obtained greater powers from Maryland's General Assembly to prosecute police-involved killings and bring such cases under civil rights law. Both Brown and Campbell said that such reform efforts were in pursuit of both improving equity and law enforcement. Better prison conditions and fairer justice systems, Campbell argued, reduce issues like recidivism and promote trust in the justice system overall. You can have accountability while also improving the conditions of confinement, Campbell said. On addressing police misconduct, for Ellison, improving outcomes in the legal system can't happen without ensuring fair and equitable policing across communities. We want the system of justice to work for defendants and for victims both. And there's no reason it shouldn't, Ellison said. He believes involvement for attorneys general is probably needed in order for it to happen. Ellison, who successfully prosecuted former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin for Floyd's murder, doesn't believe such a high-profile case of accountability for police misconduct by itself signaled a meaningful shift in police relations with underserved communities. One of my big worries after the Floyd case is that now people get to say, well, you know, we convicted that guy, move on, Ellison said. Ellison reflected on how his experience as a black man informed Chauvin's prosecution. I knew right off that, based on my life experience, they're probably going to smear Floyd, Ellison said, referencing the various tropes he had expected the defense to use. If I hadn't walked the life that I walk, I'm not sure I would have been able to see that coming. He also noted that no federal policing legislation had been passed since the national protest in the wake of Floyd's murder. That didn't mean progress had not been made in Ellison's eyes, who pointed out various states and local reforms, including in Minnesota, which have enacted higher standards on police training, reforms on practices like no-knock warrants, and instituted chokehold bans. Such changes are often facilitated by black lawmakers and law enforcement officials. Raul recalled working on police reform measures with Republican legislators, several of whom were former law enforcement officers. Being a black man in a position of power during that particular time gave me a voice where I was able to get unanimity, Ford said. Campbell doesn't see public safety and racial justice as mutually exclusive. You can absolutely make sure that we are giving law enforcement every tool they need, every resource they need to do their jobs effectively, while at the same time taking on the misappropriation of funds, police misconduct, police brutality. All of that can happen at once, she said. On protecting democracy and the rule of law. On issues such as voting rights and election interference, black prosecutors have also drawn national attention for litigating cases examining potential election fraud and voter disenfranchisement. I took an oath of office when I got elected to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States and the state of Nevada, Ford said. And I didn't know that literally meant we'd be protecting democracy in the sense that folks would be pushing back on the legitimacy of our elections and undermining our democracy. In the aftermath of the 2020 election, his office litigated six lawsuits against Donald Trump's presidential campaign and allied groups, which argued without evidence that widespread voter fraud had corrupted Nevada's elections. In November, Ford's office opened an investigation into the slate of electors Nevada Republicans drafted that falsely certified Trump had won the state's votes in the Electoral College. The lawsuit is the latest in a string of efforts by prosecutors at all levels of government to pursue potential criminal wrongdoing by Trump and his allies in efforts to overturn the 2020 election. Two black prosecutors, Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis in Georgia and Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg in New York, are prosecuting cases on related issues, as is a special counsel in the U.S. Department of Justice. The efforts have not come without criticism. Trump has lambasted James, Bragg, and Willis with language often evoking racist and stereotypical tropes, such as using terms like animal and rabbit to describe black district attorneys. James, who has sued Trump in a civil fraud case in which she argues the real estate mogul misrepresented the values of his assets around the world in financial statements to banks and insurance companies, said Trump tends to use his multiple legal entanglements as a microphone to sow more distrust of governmental institutions. He unfortunately plays upon individuals' fears and lack of hope and their disillusion in how the system has failed them. That's why he's garnered so much support, James said of Trump. He claims he wants to make America great again, but the reality is that America is already exceptional, James said. It's unfortunate that we are so polarized because of the insecurities of one man. On public safety and community needs. Public safety, the cost of living, and other material needs are top of mind for most Americans since the coronavirus pandemic caused a spike in crime and economic anxiety. Attorneys general have broad mandates in administering resources, meaning they often can be nimbler in responding to pressing challenges than legislators. You don't solve crimes unless you have communities that trust that they can go to law enforcement, said Raul, the Illinois Attorney General. And people don't trust that they can go to law enforcement if they think that law enforcement is engaging in unconstitutional policing. Allison and James both said a top priority was housing. We've sued a lot of bad landlords, Allison said. James said she was focused on real estate investors buying large amounts of working and middle-class housing across her state, as well as cracking down on deed theft and rental discrimination in New York City. Allison has also established a wage theft unit in his office, which he says was informed by the experience of Black Americans. The prosecutors learn from each other's crime-fighting techniques but aren't uniform in their strategies. Ford said he can't just do a cut-and-paste job for constituencies as diverse as his. But Raul, for instance, has spearheaded a crackdown on retail store theft in Illinois that Brown has begun to emulate in Maryland. We do have significant authority to do a lot at once, Campbell said. Divisiveness at the federal level has prompted many people to turn to local and state officials for action, she said. On increasing Black representation among prosecutors. Even as the number of high-profile Black attorneys in the legal system has risen, many Black lawmakers, district attorneys, attorneys general, and judges are often still a barrier breaker in their communities and in some cases the country. While the interviewed officials say they stay in touch with all their peers, they also lean on their fellow Black attorneys general in unique ways. Keith Ellison and I served together in Congress. He was an inspiration to me when I was making the decision to move from Congress to the Attorney General, Brown said. The group is in frequent communication through text, calls, and even joint travel domestically and abroad as they build working and personal relationships with each other. We have a little group and we're in regular communication. We boost each other up. We stick with each other and celebrate each other a lot, Ellison said. The group views that collaboration as increasingly necessary due to a rising amount of litigation specifically aimed at issues of great interest to Black communities, several attorneys general said. There's an assault going on, an intentional assault against opportunities for the Black community at large and on diversity and inclusion, Raul said. Raul cited lawsuits against diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives in areas ranging from higher education, contracting, and employment opportunities as evidence of a coordinated, well-funded assault on opportunity, he said. We cannot be found asleep at the wheel. The group also uses their growing size and shared perspective as Black Americans to influence other attorneys general around the country. We know that we collectively force a conversation in the attorney general community at large simply by us being there, Raul said. That's not to say we don't debate with each other, and that's healthy as well. But we force a conversation that needs to be had. James dismissed her barrier-breaking accolades as nothing more than historical footnote. All that history means nothing to me, nor to anyone else. People only look at results, James said. Every day I wake up and make sure that I will still have this fire in my belly for justice. Sweet, sweet justice. Being the first, James said, doesn't do anything to feed my soul. For most Black attorneys general, the work is ongoing. If we made a change, it's been incremental. I think it would be a little presumptuous of us to think we've changed the system, Ellison said. We might be changing the system, Hopefully, we are. That was the Associated Press article titled, America's Black Attorneys General Discuss Race, Politics, and the Justice System. It was written by Matt Brown and published December 1st, 2023. My next reading is from Barron's Magazine and its Barron's.com website. The title is, Philanthropy is Stepping Up to Advance Reparations and Racial Repair. It was written by Abby Schultz and published December 6, 2023. The Minnesota-based Bush Foundation approved two community trust funds totaling $100 million in 2021 to issue grants that tackle racial wealth gaps affecting indigenous and black communities in its region, including the Dakotas and 23 Native American nations within those states. The foundation, which was established by Archibald Bush, an executive at the multinational company that became 3M, and his wife Edith, created the community funds to address the result of generations of unjust policies that have harmed these communities. There are direct through lines from broken treaties to unemployment rates, slavery to incarceration rates, redlining to home ownership rates, the foundation said at the time. The funds, which are being overseen by community-based groups, represent one way philanthropy can approach reparations. A huge topic that, simply defined, includes restitution and repair, according to research from the Bridgespan Group, a global philanthropic advisory nonprofit, and Liberation Ventures, a field catalyst and intermediary working to accelerate the Black-led movement for racial repair. In a recent paper titled Philanthropy's Role in Reparations in Building a Culture of Racial Repair, the nonprofits focus on blacks in the United States, but their findings hold parallel lessons for Native Americans and others who have suffered from inequitable U.S. policies. Research for the paper included interviews with more than 45 movement leaders, academics and funders, and a survey of senior philanthropic leaders. The North Star for the reparations movement is federal comprehensive policy that addresses the legacy of slavery and the centuries of documented race-based policies, such as Jim Crow laws and redlining that marginalized black homeowners, according to the report. Inextricably linked to creating a federal policy, which report author and Liberation Ventures co-founder Aria Florent says is a 25-year goal, is building and sustaining a culture of racial repair. When I talk about reparations, I'm talking about both financial and non-financial. I'm talking about holistic repair, Florence says. A good example of what this looks like is in Germany, where the memory of the Holocaust is built into its culture, she says. You cannot grow up in Germany not understanding the Holocaust and not understanding what made the Holocaust happen, Florence says. There's a capacity being built in a citizenry related to how you build for a more just and equitable world. That's what we're talking about. Specifically, the paper describes repair as a multifaceted solution to the racial wealth gap that includes but goes beyond compensation to learning how harm was caused, to being willing to take responsibility from benefiting from inequitable systems, and to acknowledging that harm was caused. What donors can do. Philanthropy's role is not to achieve reparations alone, but it can begin to close the financial and cultural gaps that exist in creating a pathway for reparations to take hold, the authors argue. A big way is by tackling the estimated $11.2 trillion wealth gap between blacks and whites, as the Bush Foundation is aiming to do. Closing the gap will not only support black communities, it will add an estimated $1 trillion or more to the U.S. economy, the report said. To get there means addressing the fact that blacks aren't benefiting from the estimated $84 trillion intergenerational wealth transfer underway between the baby boom generation and their heirs. According to the report, this lack of wealth transfer drives 60% of a $330 billion annual disparity in wealth flow between white and black families. The $16 trillion expected to be transferred from baby boomers in just the next decade is 43% more than is needed to wipe out the black-white wealth gap altogether, the report said. Philanthropy, often funded through intergenerational wealth, is therefore in a good position to turn the tide. For that to happen, institutional philanthropy, meaning foundations large and small, will first need to reckon with the history and origin of their wealth, says Tanyelle Edwards, a partner at BridgeSpan who co-wrote the research paper. Many philanthropies already are. Researchers spoke with an individual who went through this process of investigation, and though their family didn't own slaves, there was the recognition that they benefited from the policies and practices that have been in place, Edwards says. Next, philanthropy should look at resourcing the reparations ecosystem, which is underfunded and often relies on volunteers. The report begins with the story of Bruce's Beach in Los Angeles, which was taken from a black couple, Willa and Charles Bruce, more than 100 years ago by local government officials. When the land was finally returned to Bruce's heirs in 2021, the board of supervisors said the injustice of seizing the property wasn't just inflicted on the couple, but generations of their descendants who would almost certainly be millionaires today if they had been allowed to keep their beachfront property. The injustice only received attention because of the work of several women volunteers. That's something kind of perverse about the idea of unpaid labor working to get to this place, which is why resourcing this work is needed, Edwards says. A lead organizer of the effort, Kavon Ward, has since established the nonprofit Where Is My Land, and according to the report, has a waiting list of 700 black families with similar compelling claims. In addition to land ownership, the report details organizations that are addressing reparation and repair in their criminal legal system, in the media, and in education, where organizations are fighting against a well-funded movement to erase history and the root causes of inequity. Edwards emphasizes that philanthropies don't need to abandon their missions to address education, housing, climate, democracy, or arts and culture, or any number of important issues to tackle reparations. If you do the work to get to the root of where things are, reparations are at the root of it, and it aligns with most portfolios, she says. Foundations can also re-examine where they are investing their endowment assets outside of the 5% that federal law requires to be granted to nonprofits each year. Those assets can be invested with black-owned investment managers and directed to mission-related investments that support black communities. Philanthropy has an important role to play in supporting the movement and to helping build that culture of healing and repair, Edwards says. If you want to get to a thriving multiracial democracy, then this is an imperative as a part of the portfolio. In doing research on donors who had succeeded in big at-scale culture and policy change efforts, Florent and others realized many had collaborated with a group of like-minded funders with long-term goals. They were giving in alignment with each other as well as with the movement, she says. In response, Liberation Ventures is co-creating with a steering committee of movement leaders a reparations grant-making blueprint, a 10-year strategic plan expected to be completed early next year that can serve as a focal point for a donor collaborative, Florent says. We will be creating this tool knowing that so many funders are going back to their boards, their families, and advocating for this issue, and we want to make it as easy as possible for them to do that, she says. The idea is for funders working in various realms to understand the scope of reparations and to recognize, this is my piece of the puzzle, and I can see how it fits into everything else. That was the article titled, Philanthropy is Stepping Up to Advance Reparations and Racial Repair. It appeared in Barron's Magazine's Barron's.com website on December 6, 2023. I'm going to wrap up today's program with a book review from the New York Times. The title of the book is Becoming Ella Fitzgerald, the Jazz Singer Who Transformed American Song, and was written by Judith Tick. The review was written by Dwight Garner and published December 4, 2023. Ella Fitzgerald was born in 1917 in Newport News, Virginia, but spent most of her childhood in a poor section of Yonkers, New York. Her father, a longshoreman, left the family when she was young. Her mother did domestic work and toiled in a commercial laundry. Ella didn't make it past junior high. She worked briefly as a lookout for a brothel and was arrested for truancy. She spent time in an institution for troubled youth. She later told a relative she had been molested as a girl. She thought she might become a dancer. Her break came when she was 17 at an amateur night at the Apollo Theater. She got over a bad case of stage fright and sang a Hoagie Carmichael song, Judy. A young Benny Carter was the musical director that night. Among those taken with her in the shows to come was the band leader Chick Webb, whose music had a hot, powerful style. He hired her. Big band girl singers were fresh bait in those days, Margo Jefferson has written, dangled in front of audiences to soothe their souls and stir their hormones. Some thought Fitzgerald was too plain-looking for the role, but her multi-octave voice and high spirits removed all doubts. Her first hit was A Tisket a Tasket, which teased jazz out of a nursery rhyme. In becoming Ella Fitzgerald, the jazz singer who transformed American song, Judith Tick recounts, almost concert by concert, how Fitzgerald was thrown straight into the deep end. In 1938, at the Savoy Ballroom, Count Basie's band faced off against Webb's in a battle of the bands. Billie Holiday was singing with Basie, so it was a battle of vocalists as well. Louis Armstrong and Benny Goodman were in the audience. In his novel, The Interrogative Mood, the one in which every sentence is a question, Patchett Powell asks, have you decided yet what historical moment you would have most liked to have witnessed with your own eyes and ears? That night at the Savoy would surely be high on many lists. A slew of recording sessions and a lot of travel followed. Goodman tried to poach Fitzgerald from Webb. After Webb died of tuberculosis in 1939 at 34, Fitzgerald briefly led his band. Before long, she was recording with Armstrong, whom she learned to lovingly imitate, and touring with Dizzy Gillespie. She performed in the All-Star Concert Series Jazz at the Philharmonic. Oscar Peterson played with her, and in his memoir he recounted her musical confidence. She was fronting the greatest jazz musicians alive, but she was unfazed. On the finale each night, she courageously took on the frontline horns, regardless of who they were. Ella traded fours, eights, sixteens, or whatever they wanted with them and never got hurt. As a matter of fact, on various nights when some of the horns got a smidgen careless, Fitz would run up over them and keep right on going. Fitzgerald stared down the jazz critics, too, who felt that vocalists, especially female vocalists, cheapened jazz, diluted it, and stole attention from the playing. Tick is a professor emerita of music history at Northeastern University, whose books include a biography of Ruth Crawford Seeger, the modernist composer who also happened to be Pete Seeger's stepmother. She chronicles the slights and insults Fitzgerald faced as a black woman on tour, especially in the South. During the Civil Rights era, some wished Fitzgerald had been more outspoken. She felt she spoke more clearly through her work. Tick's biography builds toward and finds its sweet spot in Fitzgerald's eight initial songbook albums for Verve, recorded between 1956 and 1964. She had impeccable taste. She revisited and modernized songs by Cole Porter, Rodgers and Hart, Duke Ellington, Irving Berlin, George and Ira Gershwin, Harold Arlen, Jerome Kern, and Johnny Mercer. In the process, Tick writes, she laid the foundational stones for what would soon be known as the Great American Songbook. Fitzgerald has proved to be a difficult subject for biographers. She would be remote in person and withholding in interviews. A previous biography by Stuart Nicholson in 1994 devolved in its second half into a blur of concert dates. Tick's book delivers the same blur. It's as if a Bob Dylan archivist were dryly printing every set list of his never-ending tour. Like Dylan, Fitzgerald was a hardened road warrior, as if performing nonstop would keep depression and even death at bay. There are decades of television appearances on every talk and variety show from Glenn Campbell's to Flip Wilson's to Chronicle as well. None of this takes us closer to her. Academic language creeps like mold into this biography. Aretha Franklin's song Respect is an intersectional anthem. Elsewhere, the verbiage is as impersonal as a rental car agreement. Black variety entertainment flourished in a separate cultural milieu through entrepreneurial adaptation and new social relationships. Tick clearly reveres Fitzgerald's music, but her prose is buttoned up. She can't quite transmit her enthusiasms or make her distinctions stick. Many listeners, then and now, find Fitzgerald's recordings to be aloof and impersonal. In her introduction to a 2016 book on Billie Holiday, Zadie Smith, channeling Holiday, writes, "All respect to Ella, all respect to Sarah. But when those girls open their mouths to sing, well, to you it's like someone just opened a brand new Frigidaire. A chill comes over you." It doesn't matter that Tick doesn't use Smith's comment, but there is a sense of easy layups missed. There are relatively few female voices in this book, which makes one miss Margot Jefferson's devastatingly fine writing on Fitzgerald. Jefferson has described being embarrassed to watch Fitzgerald on television when she was a teenager because Fitzgerald would sweat on stage. The perspiration threatened to drag her back into the maw of working-class black female labor. In a book short on humanizing detail, I was surprised to find a single sentence devoted to Fitzgerald's cookbook collection. Tick doesn't describe this collection, nor tell you that the 300 or so titles are housed in Radcliffe's Schlesinger Library. Apparently, Fitzgerald didn't cook from these books, but simply loved to read them, which makes her a kindred spirit to me. It's poignant to note that she had diabetes, so she surely could not always have eaten what she longed to. She annotated her cookbooks in the margins. Who would not want to know, in two or three paragraphs, what she put there? Tick doesn't say, nor does she note that Fitzgerald was said to have floor-to-ceiling bookshelves in every room of her house, and that she kept letters and other things inside her books. It's poor sportsmanship, perhaps, to write about what isn't in a book as opposed to what is. But even browsing a Sotheby's catalog of Fitzgerald's memorabilia auctioned off in 1997 gives you a deeper sense of her personal style than Tick manages to convey. According to the Chicago Tribune, a pair of her fake eyelashes sold for $900. Nor does Tick describe Fitzgerald's Beverly Hills house, though there are many photos online. It looks a bit like Larry David's place on Curb Your Enthusiasm, or her rare and elegant cars. She didn't drive, but enjoyed being chauffeured. Unanalyzed, too, is what catnip Fitzgerald was to many of the last century's most incisive photographers, including Lee Friedlander and Annie Leibovitz. Her supposedly plain looks are a blank canvas of a sort, into which others read volumes. Tick's book warms again as she approaches the end of Fitzgerald's life in 1996. When she was in failing health, she liked to listen to her old records and tried to remember everything. On one of her last days, her son hired a trio of excellent musicians to play for her. They were downstairs, she was upstairs, and the beautiful sound traveled up to find her. That was a review of the book, Becoming Ella Fitzgerald, the jazz singer who transformed American song, written by Judith Tick. The review was written by Dwight Garner and published in the New York Times Book Review on December 4th, 2023. That's all the time we have this week. If you would like to listen to this program again, or past editions of the African American Hour, you can find them wherever you get your podcasts or at the Audio Reader website at reader.ku.edu. I'm Byron Buckner, and thank you for listening to the African American Hour.